Oh, welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. We talked about book stuff.
Just, like, I'm so delighted every week not knowing what the, like, sort of falsely excited introduction is going to be. Like, everything's great at the Book Riot.
This one is supposed to be like you're in on a secret here at the Book Riot Podcast. Yeah, you know, you're listening. You know what's up. You know that we talk about books and reading and cool stuff around books and reading. If it's not cool, it could be new. And if it's not cool or new, it also could be interesting or all three. Today is August 13th, 2020. Winding down summer. I'm going to be out next week sitting around some other house not doing things. But I am very much looking forward to it. I am mustering whatever is to be mustered today. So we'll see how it happens. We're going to start with some listener emails. We're going to, tomorrow we're recording our favorite reads of the summer. That's not coming out for a little while, but, I've got some emails from people, but you can still email us for sure, but we're not going to make it into the show or anything else for the show we're actually recording, because we're going to do that tomorrow. Thank you. Got some interesting responses there. Really, you know, as we suggested, really no big book of the summer. There's some things that have sold, as we'll talk about, a new one that sold especially well, but none of those made those onto the list. Interesting mix of backlist and idiosyncratic mentions from our listeners. Speaking of idiosyncratic listeners' mentions, we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's take care of a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family, and lovers, and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
All right, I dropped these on you late in the game. Benjamin wrote in with a point I wish I would have thought of. Maybe you did and didn't articulate it, relating to the Patrick Rothfuss, George R. R. Martin slowness. I don't want to use a euphemism. I don't want to throw shade right yet. I'm ready. I'll throw shade when I want to, but not right now. And he said he thought it was odd that neither of us mentioned the fact that being a wealthy cishet older white man plays a huge role in their choice not to finish a publisher work, maybe, speculating. You mentioned in the most recent episode how romance authors and authors like N.K. Jemisin and Zen Cho consistently publish books in their series. My gut feeling is the reason these authors publish consistently is due to the fact they are significantly underpaid by publishing as women and people of color. These authors simply can't go 9 years, when you put it like that, 9 years without publishing a book because they couldn't put foot on the table. I'll give my reaction first because I've thought about it a little bit more, Rebecca, or do you want to go first?
Yeah. You can go first.
I think Benjamin, you're absolutely right. I mean, of course it's a factor. Now, how much of a factor is a different question altogether. That Patrick Rothfuss and George R. R. Martin as cishet white men is related, but maybe not intimately intertwined with the fact that the real thing, which is that they've got juice, that they can wait that long because people are going to buy the books. Like, they've got this series, they've got power in the form of series people care about, and the cost to, I think, Song of Ice and Fire's Random House doubled. I can't remember. I think it's a Random House title. And then, of course, the Kingkiller Chronicles is DAW, as we've talked about. We're not quite ad nauseum, but ad pre-nauseum a little bit. It costs more for those publishers even now to jettison those titles because they're expecting them to come at some point. They don't gain anything really by getting rid of it. And the pent-up demand, the power of those series is such that they've got leverage, right? Rothfuss and Martin have leverage not to do this, not to do this being publish more consistently and fairly. Now, were they given a chance to gain that juice differently because they're white men? I would have to assume yes, not knowing anything about it. Like, tie goes to yes in this sort of situation. But if, let's say, if Song of Ice and Fire was written by a black woman and it had the cultural capital it has right now, I think that black woman would still be able to wait 9 years. I think she'd still be in the same position. I'm sure the calls among the internet would be worse, right? I'm sure the abuse would be differently tinged. But I don't think the publisher would be doing anything significantly different. Now, I could be wrong about that, but this is my gut. Is like, once you move units at that scale, you have a lot of latitude to be slow. And I'm sure it would be a little bit different, but I actually don't know that it would be an order of magnitude different. But that's my initial reaction. Rebecca, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I just saw this like 5 minutes before the show started, and I had a very, you know, like forehead slapping response.
Me too.
I really, I wish that that we had thought of that. I know, looking at the stories, I was so just like, what on earth is Betsy Wolheim doing? that these details were not as front of mind as I wish that they were consistently, and especially the intersectional approach that you have written in here, Benjamin. And I think N.K. Jemisin is a great example, specifically because she has talked openly about what she was paid for the books. And when we talked back in June, I just had to Google this quickly, about the hashtag publishing paid me when Black Lives Matter was first ramping back up this round, and folks were talking about inequity in a bunch of industries. Jemisin revealed that she got $25,000 in advance for each of the three books in the Broken Earth trilogy, and that she like really, really had to wrestle her way to a $100,000 advance for her latest one. It was for, what is the latest one called? The City We Became.
The City We Became, yeah.
Yes. And that in between that, the follow-up trilogy, Great Cities, she had $60,000 in advance per volume. And those are, you know, big numbers, but also not huge numbers relative to, like, especially the world of George R. R. Martin and Patrick Rothfuss. So it's a great point. I think also, I was thinking along the same lines that you were, Jeff, of like, if a black woman had the opportunity to, you know, publish enough books to gain the kind of clout for a series and build up this much juice and demand, they could probably have a delay like this far enough along in their career, but the public response would be so much worse. Mm-hmm. And the abuse online would be really, really awful. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of disincentive for that for a lot of reasons. And the primary one is that opportunities are still so gated and still so limited for women and people of color, and especially for women of color in publishing, that if you are N.K. Jemisin and you're breaking these records by being a black woman publishing a sci-fi fantasy series and winning a bunch of awards, but still having to wrestle your way to a $100,000 advance, you're the exception still, and you don't want to squander. Like, there's no room to squander that opportunity either for herself or for black women who may come after her and be seen as an unfortunate example of, you know, publishing feeding itself that lie of like why they are not going to continue publishing Jemisin or continue publishing authors like her. There's a lot of responsibility on these folks who are the first or the only or one of the only. I think Zen Cho is another good example. Benjamin, as an Asian woman writing science fiction fantasy and getting, you know, I think relatively good publicity behind that. I don't know what Cho was paid for those books, that there's a lot of social pressure there to deliver, because opening up new opportunities shouldn't depend on these few people who have been allowed into the system delivering their individual things, but it does in some ways because of how messed up things are. So great, great point.
Yeah. It's a wonderful point. I'm glad we got, Benjamin, you wrote in with the opportunity to talk about. I think the other thing that's maybe the layer underneath the layer is that I think a woman, or a person of color, a woman of color, LGBTQ plus, whatever it might be, that isn't a cishet white man like Patrick Rothfuss and George R. R. Martin would be, it may not be that they would be given less slack. I think because of how people are trained to understand culture, they'd be a lot less willing to try to take the slack, maybe is maybe a different way of thinking about it.
Yes, that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think you were circling around that essentially, sort of, I'm not sure exactly what, but the internalized, either internalized racism or the double consciousness, to use the Du Boisian term, that they will be judged differently, will make women and people of color especially sensitive to the pressures. Perception of pressures or of double standards. And so they'll be less likely to drag their feet in a way that maybe they have a right to, frankly. Maybe George R. R. Martin and Patrick Rothfuss have a right to drag their feet. That's the other side of this, is like, you know what? They have it's their series. Go read something else if you're that mad about it. I mean, that's the other piece of this, is rather than thinking of it as something that's done wrong, it's like, take up the space. Use your leverage. Great. I mean, on the other, there's a part of me that's like that. You build an incredible franchise that a bunch of people care about. Enjoy it. Do what you want to do. I think that double standard, triple standard, quadruple standard, depending on how you think about it, would come into play in a lot different and pernicious ways that we wouldn't be able to see, right? Or even get a chance to talk about.
Yeah. And I think related to that is the awareness that, like, and we're doing it, like, we're illustrating it here, that Rothfuss and Martin, like, we're talking about them as individuals.
Yep.
We're talking about, like, look at these two guys who have done this thing. Because publishing is filled with examples of cishet white men who have not dragged their feet for 9 years to finish their, you know, to finish their series. And so it just looks like these two individuals where, like, to go back to the N.K. Jemisin example, there's a lot of disincentive for her to ever do something like this, because as one of the only black women in her position, she won't be seen as an individual person doing this thing. She'll be seen as an example of black women given these opportunities, and look what happened.
Yeah. It's fascinating. The data set is so small for women and people of color who are bestsellers in genre, especially bestsellers. We've talked about this before, you know, just of any kind. But also the sample size of, like, culture making franchises like Song of Ice and Fire, that it's hard to cross examine. But I think you could do worse than to assume if the identities were different here, the reaction would be different. Cause it's bad now for Martin. I can't imagine Martin's enjoying it. It would be much worse. If he didn't have the other kinds of privileges happening at the same time. Kind of relatedly around, Megan wrote in with, I would say, a admirably vulnerable kind of email. So I want to commend her for this too. And she, you know, doing a lot of asking for apologies, no reason to apologize. These are difficult things. And for many people, I'll throw myself into that particular ring. These are new and different ways of understanding relationship to reading, to art, to culture of various different kinds. So I'm going to read a little bit at length here. She's looking for something to hold on to, having a reaction to an experience and looking for something to hold on. So this is non-rhetorical. I think it's important. It's hard to know, but how much as a consumer reader recommender do we need to research an author? For example, in the past month, I've seen two influencers / mommy bloggers on Instagram and a couple of old high school friends on Facebook mention how amazing American Dirt was to read. And I was like, how did you miss everything from earlier this year? One of those influencers also said, yeah, don't forget, the places you'll go for graduation. Okay, that's a funny running gag on this show. And people told her how problematic Seuss is. I assume that's about his anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So she found two less popular books to share, and she got comments on my things jumping around on how one of those authors had some sexual allegations brought against him, at which point she admitted defeat and just gave up. Okay, so that's the story she was seeing. And then related to her own situation, or her own sort of a couple of mental models she has, I won't buy Ender's Game because Card states he used that money to fund anti-gay stuff. But Dr. Seuss is dead. Is buying Cat in the Hat hurting anyone? Do I need to Google C.S. Lewis plus controversy before reading Chronicles of Narnia to my kids? Do I need to do that for everyone? I realize some of this is my white, fragile self feeling defensive, but I hope this email doesn't make me sound too dramatic. I'm just curious for your thoughts. Mm-hmm. She clearly is struggling with something I think is very difficult to understand. I think, Megan, you are right that part of this, not to put it on too fine a point on it, is white fragility, to be perfectly honest with you. Mm-hmm. But I think some of it is also fair, and interesting. I've got some thoughts, Rebecca. I want to give you a chance if you want to start, or how, what did you pick up as being the most interesting part of this question?
We'll start. You know, like, I think we can extend fragility and into the idea of, like, work. Like, we're being asked to do work around things in our lives that have not, white people with privilege are being asked to do work around things in our lives that have not been work before. Mm-hmm. That if we, that we're being asked to care and pay a new kind of attention and apply a new level of intention to how we choose things. And that it, like, it feels like a burden. I understand, or it can feel like a burden. I understand, you know, the frustration that the person Megan's writing about, who, like, you know, tried one book and got bad feedback about that, and then picked up two others and got bad feedback about those, and just gave up, and that can feel overwhelming. I think for me, it helps to remember that the really bad actors in the world in general, and in, like, the folks who publish books, are still a minority percentage of what's available to us. And so, like, that person who, you know, struck out with Dr. Seuss and then with two other children's book authors, like, they had a bad run, but there are a lot of good things still available. I'll offer my personal approach is to pay attention to news and media sources and individuals who are also plugged into things that are going to surface this kind of information. So, like, you know, obviously we knew about what was happening with American Dirt because we work in publishing, but if there's a TV or a movie equivalent, I try to follow folks and publications that are going to surface that for me. And then I can go from there to do more research. Like, there are probably people in the world who do Google the author of every book they consider buying and reading, or who are looking at, like, the deep info about the producer of every movie that they're thinking about watching. And, like, that is I think that's a really astonishing and impressive level of attention and scrutiny to give to stuff. I have not made that deep of a commitment to it. You know, like, I'm not doing that much work. The place that I've gone for myself, because I think that what you're wishing here is that there could be, like, one principle to rule them all, you know, that we could say, here is exactly what you should do. So maybe it'll help you to know, like, of the, what, like, 10 of us on the editorial staff at Book Riot, I think we have a shared set of core principles about how we do this, but how we apply them individually in our reading choices is really does vary. And then when you spread that out to our 200 writers, it's also really varied what people do. I think you have to decide for yourself, how much work you are willing to do, to achieve the level of, like, feeling good about what you're putting into your brain or what you're introducing to your children. So, like, C.S. Lewis and controversy, maybe you don't need to Google it. Like, she notes here that she's remembering the last book being a bit harsh, but maybe you just need to reread that last book by yourself and determine if it feels okay to you to read it to your kids. You know, based on what you know of your values, is that going to jive? Like, Jeff, you were just telling me yesterday about a book that that your partner was reading to your kids. It's a book we all love.
Yep. And we will talk about on the show in the future, actually.
From our younger years, and that she realized, you know, getting into it, like, nope, this doesn't jive anymore. Like, this is not where we're going anymore. So I think there's that work. You know, if you can establish some good solid principles, like, I'm not going to buy books by people who have, you know, allegations of assault or rape against them. I'm not going to buy books by people who are doing racist stuff out in the world and causing harm. Those lists are longer than they should be, but they're not so long that they're actually going to, like, inhibit your ability to choose things. And now it does seem like the really egregious stuff is getting surfaced. So, like, your high school friends on Facebook probably didn't hear about the American Dirt controversy because they're looking for the headline about, like, what is the next big book club pick that some mainstream publication is going to put out. They're not following, like, they're not reading Book Riot, you know, like, they're not following book news. And that's just the difference between being on the sort of insider level of paying attention to a particular industry or being a casual consumer of it, which is what I assume. I'm making these assumptions about those folks on Instagram and American Dirt that, you know, that's a lot to think about, like Googling the author of every book you read, but also you could do it. And almost always, I think the results of that Google would be like, hey, this is probably fine. So maybe those 2 minutes are worth it for your peace of mind. I don't think there's just one good way to do this. The thing that's worked for me is having a couple like solid principles. And one of them for me is the distinction between, am I putting money in this person's pocket? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like for Dr. Seuss, and we have a weird situation with Book Riot because we have a public platform to talk about and recommend things. Like I might feel okay about, you know, spending money on a book by a dead author if I know that that money's not going to something gross. But I might not publicly recommend that book, or encourage other people to spend money on stuff that they might feel strange about. I still have attachments to books by people who it has turned out have mm-hmm. gross things in their past. And it hasn't changed how those books impacted me, but it does change the fact, like, I won't recommend them to anybody, mm-hmm. you know? I think J.K. Rowling is an interesting example where, you know, we can talk about Harry Potter means a lot to a lot of people, but, like, that's coming with a big asterisk for me. Mm-hmm. This feels like a rambling answer to a very hard question, so I'm going to turn it over.
Well, there's a lot there because she's not actually just, as you mentioned, she's not actually asking one question. There's several different yeah. moments of intersecting with other people in the world about books that she's referring to. The word you started with is the same word I had in mind too, of like, this is what work feels like, right? Mm-hmm. Did you think, I'm going to be a little sharp for a moment, did you think that a fundamental cultural awakening about this stuff was going to feel good? Is that what, no, I'm serious. Cause like, if you thought yeah. that, that's something you need to get over, I think. Is that it wasn't going to be easy as a well-meaning bookish white person to change your reading habits and how you interact with other people online in your real life about books, right? The decolonization is hard. Mm-hmm. It takes work. It's a fundamental and thoroughgoing and ongoing reimagination of how we intersect with culture and the makers of culture. So my point of view is Googling C.S. Lewis plus controversy, that is not work. That's 10 seconds. Why does that bother you? I would sit with that for a minute and wonder about that. I think also this array of books that I don't know if they're representative or not. Dr. Seuss, Oh, the Places You'll Go, American Dirt by Jeanine Cummins, and the Narnia series by C.S. Lewis. They're all cishet white people. They're all readily available. Those are the lowest hanging fruit in the book chain. American Dirt through publicity and marketing. Dr. Seuss largely through the same, but also the weight of culture. And C.S. Lewis. If you want different fruit, you got to climb the tree differently, is all I'm saying here. Mm-hmm. Right? So you might think about that. I can't really sympathize with the influencer. Okay, there's two. You didn't know, you got educated and you gave up. That's white fragility. That's a bad job. That's my opinion yeah. of that. That's a terrible job. Now, how much are you expected to do? What resources you can find? I think they've got some, that person might have some real questions about what they're trying to do. Megan is like, the C.S. Lewis one I understand is like, from my point of view too, we talked about a reader writing in about Harry Potter. Like, this is something that clearly means something to you. You want to have this experience with your kids. And what you're afraid of, I think, is turning over the rock and seeing how many worms are under it. And if it's enough worms that you're willing to eat the rock, I'm not sure what's going to be under the rock. Depending yeah. on the integer number of worms you're going to see, are you going to proceed with Narnia or not? Yeah, so I think one thing I would say is, like, you know, live with that. Yeah, live with the discomfort. If you should be uncomfortable in changing how you think about books, and maybe even a notch or two more comfortable, uncomfortable than you're comfortable being, if that makes sense.
I think it should feel like a stretch.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe a little bit more than a stretch. The other thing is maybe start from a different location rather than mm-hmm. starting from the lowest hanging fruit. Start from, what do I not know about that I can recommend to other people? What do I not readily have available? Rather than doing a purity check against sort of the established, received authors and voices, how can you start from a different location about those places? So that's my sense of what's going yeah, on here.
That's that's a place that I was going to go with this too. And just to, I think this is a really good question, and a lot of readers are wrestling with it for either for the first time or in a deeper way than they have before. And I'm glad that we're going to devote some time to it here. You know, I think it might be useful for you to know, Megan, like there's a few layers of how we apply this at Book Riot, and maybe this serves as an analogy for you in your own thinking, that we have, you know, an official set of criteria that we use with the editorial team to determine when we are no longer going to publish things about a particular author. And that extends to telling the full contributor core, no more recommending these authors. It's a pretty set and deeply thought set of criteria. It's not perfect because there is not a perfect way to do this, but we need something that falls between, you know, one person mentions a thing about a person and they're automatically, you know, off the site forever. And we have to adjudicate the details of every individual case. Like, we needed a set of guidelines. So we created a set of guidelines, but there are a lot of things that arise that don't quite meet those guidelines. Mm-hmm. And we and the contributors offer each other like, hey, you turned in a post that mentions XYZ person. You know, you might not know that this thing has been going around about them. And then, you know, that person can choose, do they want to take that recommendation out of that post? I think that's a way to think for yourself about like, where is the line? And when you know something about an author who's over the line, it's automatically no, but there's a lot of gray area, and how you navigate that for yourself is something that you have to figure out on your own, and that will probably, and should, I think, evolve over time. I was also going to recommend starting from a different place. I like the way you said that, Jeff, that instead of, you know, like looking at what's popular or like, do I have to Google every single author? Starting with like maybe a commitment to, this year I'm going to, you know, spend 50% of my book dollars or 50% of my reading time or more than that on Black authors. And that's not, or, you know, folks that have been marginalized in some way. And that's not to say that there aren't people who have done these horrible things from inside those marginalized communities. You will still need to do your research. But if you give yourself something like, I'm not going to support, you know, I'm not throwing dollars at white people right now who don't need it, that removes one layer of concern, and it allows you to put your energy onto something else, you know. And this is the kind of thing, like, you know, you're talking about, you won't buy, you're not going to eat at Chick-fil-A because they use their money to fund anti-gay work. We can do, and we should be doing this research everywhere in our consumer lives. So like, you know, if I'm looking at a service or thinking about, you know, supporting a nonprofit or whatever it is, like, I want to be looking at who's on staff and who are their board of directors. Like, are there people of color represented here? Is this not just an author or an individual, but is this ultimately, and you're getting at it with the Chick-fil-A reference, a business that you want to support the like flow of dollars into and then away from that thing? It is work. Like, it just is. And Jeff is right. Like, the Google takes 10 seconds. So like, you know, if you're trying to build a 3,000 book list of like possible things you might ever read on Goodreads or something, like doing a 10 second Google of a 3,000 book list might sound like a lot. But when you're standing in front of a shelf and you're trying to decide what to read next and you've got four choices, it's probably worth the 10-second Google on each of those four choices. Or, you know, take recommendations from activists that you trust. You know, like, making your recommendation sources be not the lowest hanging fruit. Like, you know, influencers who get paid to shill the things that publishers have money to pay them to shill are maybe not the best source of recommendations.
And if you just think about some of it is doing the same amount of work, but just organizing it differently. Rather than Googling C.S. Lewis plus controversy first, maybe Google something like middle grade fantasy for kids. And one thing I could tell you, if you have a Book Riot result for that, which there will be if you scroll down a little bit, one thing that we do, at least in this, you know, posts that are less than 5 years old, at least, is we make sure those lists, I don't do any of this, our editorial staff make sure that there are names and voices that aren't just white cishet people from America. You know, there's some of those on there, but you're going to find a curated, intentional list that's more inclusive than I think you're going to find elsewhere on the internet writ large, mostly. Some exceptions to that, probably. But that might be a different way of reframing where, what kind, how much work to do and what kind of work to do. If you if you snap those Lego bricks together a little bit differently, maybe you'll find a different experience of thinking about being intentional, because you're being intentional about what you're trying to read, but the way the shape of that intentionality makes it feel like there's more friction. I think there might actually be if done a little bit differently. So good luck to you. Let us know if that was helpful at all.
Yeah. Megan. Yeah. I think the work, you know, of being a privileged white person in this society is like, you're going to bump into those feelings of fragility, and you're going to bump into defensiveness. Like, that's part of it, because we've been socialized to not have to do any of the work. So I want to say, like, these feelings that you're bumping into are normal, and they're part of the process. Yeah. Like, that you're running into discomfort is a good sign. And the job now is to just like be okay with that. And over time, it will be like, these things will be less uncomfortable, and you'll be able to then move into a new thing.
That's right.
That create, you know, a new kind of work and intention and activism in your life. And who knows what that will look like. I think it's different for everybody. Mm-hmm. That'll be uncomfortable. And then you sit with that for a while. Like, this is how dismantling works. Yeah. It doesn't feel good. It's not supposed to feel good. Ultimately, we maybe get to feel good about the incremental results of it.
And you might, I thought I wasn't going to say anything, but the other thing is, maybe the metric of feeling good isn't your metric for success here. That's another way of thinking about this. If you're solving for yourself feeling good, I might spend some time sitting with that as well in this particular moment. All right, let's do another sponsor and we'll come back to news. We were right about being wrong about Stephenie Meyer. Did we get credit for that? It's like some sort of mental jujitsu. I'm not sure how to do this necessarily, but Midnight Sun, the next installment of the retelling of the original Twilight series, sold more than 1 million units in its first week of release, making it, I believe, now the best-selling one-week release title of the year, just moving past Mary Trump's book that I can never remember the name of.
Too Much and Never Enough.
Too Much and Never Enough, yeah. It's just like my memory.
I'm pretty sure it's also a 90s pop song.
Yeah, yeah. So like now I think in terms of week one sales, we're looking at Midnight Sun, Too Much and Never Enough, and then Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, I think are the rankings for their best-selling week one books of the year so far. Not sure if there's anything else to say about that. I am very surprised, even though I was I was trying to re-anchor my surprise, but 1 million copies, I guess comparatively, that it sold more than Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, I'm very surprised by that.
Me too. And, you know, we were talking a couple weeks ago about how Isabel Wilkerson, like, lucked into publishing her big new book about caste in America in the middle of a major racial reckoning. Yep. And I think Stephenie Meyer lucked into her publication in 2020 as well. Like, for most authors, this is a difficult at best time to be releasing a book. But if you are the author of a beloved guilty pleasure series, and I'm saying that because that's what people refer to Twilight as. I do not believe in books as guilty pleasures. But if you're the author of something like that, that people read voraciously, that's escapist and fun and has
comforting.
Romance, yes.
No.
Yeah.
No.
This is, you know, the middle of 2020 is not a terrible time to be releasing a book like that. I think this book would have done well in another moment. But I think that some, probably a very small percentage, but some of this runaway success of Midnight Sun has to do with where we are right now and really how much everybody needed a book like this, or how much so many readers needed this book right now. I mean, good job, Stephenie Meyer.
Get them checks. And announced also that she was going to continuing book this series, as you would if you sold 1 million copies in 1 week.
Right.
So no real surprise there. Boy, we're already half hour in, so we might have to be a little more choosy about some of these. Where do you want to go next, Rebecca?
You know, I think this is important and heartening follow-up of a story that's been mostly frustrating mm-hmm. for a long time. We reported, or we talked about the reports.
Passed along.
Yeah. Passed along. That's the right term. Last year, Jonathan Newton, who was the head librarian of the Five Forks branch of the Greenville County Library in Greenville, South Carolina, was fired from his job after he was, quote, inappropriately involved with assisting organizers for a drag queen story hour. Now the county is settling with him for $30,000. That doesn't seem like nearly a big enough settlement for, you know, having lost your job over something like this, but it's better than nothing. And the principle of it mm-hmm. is good to see. So that is our follow-up there.
I think that was probably the result of the letter in Harper's in support of Drag Queen Story Hour. Don't you think that was probably what it was? Oh, there wasn't a letter about that.
Harper's out here really fighting the fights for things that matter.
I'm sorry. I was confused there for a second about where freedom of expression is really being challenged in America.
Salty today. I like it.
You know, I'm mad about this. You know I am. So I'm not supposed to be surprised about. As bookshop.org has had fantastic success, I don't think it's unfair to say, because of COVID. Maybe it would have had a different trajectory than it was on in January and February. We were talking about its sales, has been, more successful than it would have without it. Not to say it wouldn't have been successful to this. Last month, Bookshop divvied up a sales dividend of more than $1 million among 861 bookstores who use the site to sell books. Sounds like a lot. Is a lot, I would say, mm-hmm. right? You're looking at, or is it, Rebecca? I mean, you're looking at $1,200 a bookstore, maybe, for some of those stores. I've always been wondering, like, this is a question Jen and I, because I remember she was on the show talking with me about this. I was talking at her and being frustrated about understanding how this would be helpful. Is that enough to keep some of these stores in business or not? I mean, they'll take it, except that some of them won't.
Yeah, it's 12,000 a bookstore.
12,000 a bookstore?
Sorry, 800. No, I was doing bad math. You were right. It's 1,200.
Okay, 1,200 or so. I was like, wait a minute,
I missed a number there.
A million is 1,000,000, so we're just about 1,000 bookstores. Okay.
You're right.
I was back of the enveloping it. So
I just realized I had punched 86 into my calculator.
There you go.
861.
So besides, it sounds, so 1,200 bucks that you would have gotten anyway, except maybe not, is what the story in Publishers Weekly is sort of suggesting. Some, again, when you have this many bookstores and this many people, you're going to have some dissent no matter what, right? That's taken as read. A couple of people don't love Bookshop as independent bookstores, I don't think really necessarily means too much, except that people have different ideas. I think the thing in this story that got both of our attention was that the ABA, the American Booksellers Association, which is the professional organization for independent bookstores that advocates for them. They host, Winter Institute and a bunch of other resources, had taken a 4% stake in Bookshop, representing $100,000 cash investment, and apparently had not disclosed that to members for 7 months after, and in the discussions about Bookshop and, some of the informational stuff, didn't disclose that the ABA had a financial investment in it, that I presumably, the individual bookstores, I don't know how that works. Like, if you're a member, do you have a fractional share then? I don't really understand it. But again, sometimes the cover-up is worse than the thing. I think it makes sense that ABA would have pumped some money to this. And I think if that was part of the discussion earlier, not too many people, maybe a couple more people would have been side-eyeing it on the whole. But it is odd, I think, that this is coming out now.
That's the piece I really want to read mm-hmm. from Publishers Weekly, or from someone who's looking into this. Like, that booksellers are concerned about Bookshop competing with them is, like, booksellers have been concerned about that for as long as the ABA has been talking about mm-hmm. Bookshop. And now that there are actual numbers and examples, that conversation is being renewed. But, like, this thing that the ABA board approved the investment in February of 2019, which was 7 months before members were informed that the ABA had a, quote, affinity partnership with Bookshop, which I'm not sure what their definition of that is, but I think traditionally affinity partnership is like, we're working with you because it benefits both of us and we earn something, like affiliate. It doesn't necessarily indicate like that you made an investment. And it seems like folks are maybe just now finding out about this investment that was made. Like, how did that happen? Why wasn't it communicated? Like, what was it, an intentional cover up, or did the folks at the ABA think that they had made it clear we have this relationship with Bookshop and it wasn't clear? Like, there's a lot of ways that this could have gone sideways, but we were both just like giant eyeball emojis at this.
Literally, I mean, we literally used it in the, I used the eyeball emoji in Slack, which I am wont to do, generally speaking.
Yeah, that like, it's, you know, the ABA, booksellers pay into the ABA to receive support and, you know, professional consultation and services, and that the money that they've paid in was invested into a company that some of them feel creates competition for them, and no one was aware of the investment is a whole thing. Or maybe not no one, but it certainly seems that not nearly enough people were aware of this investment with enough detail as they should have been. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's and the report.
I have a lot of questions.
The reportage, the bylines by Alex Green. I'm not familiar with that person, but I applaud the reporting style and the pull quote used at the end here, because there's a quote from some bookseller saying, you know, we didn't know, we thought there should be more, and then a pull quote from Oren Tyker back in fall 2019, and here's the quote. Bookshop is not a program of the American Booksellers Association. It is a totally separate B corporation that is happening independently of ABA. Full disclosure, Oren Tyker was interviewed as a part of Annotated. Seems like a reasonable person. It doesn't seem to me that it is a totally separate B corporation if it is in fact the case that investment was made on behalf of the ABA in Bookshop. Not loving that, to be honest.
Yeah, and that the investment was approved by the board in February of 2019, and that quote from Tyker is from the fall of 2019, so there's months of space in there. I think the closing quote here, which is from the owner of a Toadstool bookshop, says, at the very least, there should have been a clear announcement after the deal was done, and then every subsequent communication from the ABA regarding Bookshop should have come with the disclaimer that ABA is an investor and has a financial interest in Bookshop.
Yeah.
That seems completely reasonable to me.
And for those of you who maybe haven't heard or are it's confusing. It's a confusing question of whether, you know, Bookshop's relationship to independent bookstores is not uniformly applicable, because not every independent bookstore has a uniform e-commerce strategy. Some independent bookstores have developed and cultivated a fairly robust online ordering system and told their readers to go there and use it and promote it and thought of it as an extension of the bookstore. Some other bookstores, which heretofore have de-emphasized online ordering for strategic reasons, thinking, you know, if you get people used to ordering books online, then they can more fluidly move to other retailers and that gets people out of our stores and so on and so forth. There's some retail strategy stuff that's mixed in with this. The situation here is that Bookshop.org is solving a problem that many but not all independent bookstores have. And so the ones that is not solving a pre-existing problem for, which is, you know, a robust e-commerce solution, the brand bookshop.org right now, even the way I'm talking about it right now, kind of illustrates the point that it's a thing people know to go to irrespective of their local, or maybe understanding or not knowing if their local would rather you go to their independent store because the revenue on the sales is broken up differently. It's clarifying at the very top level, bookshop.org, percentage of our sales helps independent bookstores. Great. Well, not quite that simple. I less and less have an opinion on it because it doesn't really affect me, frankly, whether or not it's good for independent bookstores. But I think it's interesting to think about, you know, that strategy in the terms of the wider independent bookstore collective, because as online makes sort of a more generalized marketplace, there is a problem that a locally focused bookstore has, because when their buyers are on the internet, they're kind of in the world, right? They're not in their local mm-hmm. locality there. So how to do the thing a local bookstore does online? Do you make this deal like, well, okay, I'll throw in my lot with Bookshop and get some other things, but knowing I'm going to maybe lose some of this other stuff? I can imagine being a very difficult spot for some people.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough spot. And for the stores that for some reason have chosen not to work with Bookshop, either because they've already got robust e-commerce strategies or they're not interested in Bookshop for whatever reason, to not be aware that like essentially their money had been invested into Bookshop without their awareness is very troubling. And this, I guess, will be interesting to see then too, if there's fallout at the board level for the ABA, if the board members are asked to account for this in some capacity and what that might make changes to the board look like.
All right, let's do a last sponsor and then a couple of bullet items before we go. This is late breaking, something I'm going to try for sure. Merriam-Webster has a podcast, which I'm actually surprised it took this late, because Merriam-Webster as a brand entity is very media savvy. So if you would have asked me before knowing this, would you guess that Merriam-Webster already has a podcast? I would have said yes. Is that fair, Rebecca? I don't know. What do you think?
I would have not been surprised,
okay.
I guess.
Yeah,
I
okay, fair, yeah, fair,
yeah.
fair.
I've been like, oh yeah, sure, that makes sense.
So they're going to be talking about dictionary related things. So as listeners of this show, I imagine there'd be quite a bit of crossover there. Maybe we'll have to listen to a couple episodes and do reactions. I'm sure wherever your podcast player of choice will have the directory, just look for Merriam-Webster. LA Times Festival of the Book going online today, and it's just a matter of time. I mean, maybe we should have that segment, just a matter of time. I'm not sure. I guess I the thing that got me thinking about this again is the clock ticking on BEA 2021, Rebecca?
Oh, man, I think it is.
It is, right?
Yeah, I think the question here, that, like in my mind at least, is not so much are these events going to go online or not, as are they going to go online or not happen at all?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So like the LA Times Festival of the Book has decided to move online. It was just announced, I think, yesterday that New York Comic Con, which is scheduled for October of this year, is going online. And our best guess sort of all around is that also happens at Javits. A lot of events that are happening at Javits have been canceled like pretty late. Like, obviously, there's not going to be a con in New York City in the Javits Center 3 months from right now. But maybe some insurance stuff going on there. I don't think we're going to Book Expo in May of 2021.
I don't think so either.
I don't think it's happening. I don't think anybody's going.
I always make this joke that September 1st is meaningfully different than August 31st in my mind, but it's just one day of the calendar, right? That's the difference between summer and fall in my mind. And we're coming up on like in 3 weeks, it's going to be September, and March is going to be just 6 months away, essentially, you know, and then when we start getting to actually having to make plans for this kind of stuff. You and I have talked about this offline and, you know, personal and other sort of work-related context, but like, well, V plus three, the title of last week's show, vaccine plus 3 months is my new standard for anything like normal life coming back. And I'd throw BEA happening back into normal life. You know, I'm not going to be surprised to see that at all. I do wonder about the holiday shopping season as it relates to bookstores. I don't know if we covered this on the show at all, but like Target and Walmart and a bunch of retailers are going to be closed for Thanksgiving and maybe the day after for crowding reasons. But I also think Black Friday is one of those things that sort of no one likes, I feel like. Like most people don't like, and the people who participate in it do it for, you know, financial reasons, kind of, you know, it's not like going to Disneyland or something, which right now you probably shouldn't be doing anyway. But using this as a moment to say, you know what, maybe this whole thing has gotten away from us makes sense. But those Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays in December for independent bookstores writ large are hugely lucrative. And I wonder how much it'll have effect. Maybe people will buy online from their local bookstore and it'll come out in the wash or maybe ahead or, you know, maybe not that bad. But, you know, we're every day we are in this COVID land, it's the first day of that date that we've ever tried in this. So there's more days coming to see this happening. Where do you want to go? Anything else? What do you want to hit?
let's see. I felt like I did have something, and then my brain just completely, because we're in COVID land, my brain completely wiped. Let's talk about Elizabeth Moss for a second.
Yeah, I dropped this in then. Running gags, running questions, open questions. Elizabeth Moss has signed on to star in a film adaptation of a forthcoming book called Mrs. March, which is a feature film. The author, his name is Virginia Fito. And the plot, did you read the plot to this? An Upper East Side housewife who starts to lose her grip on reality when she begins to suspect her novelist husband based the odious central character in his latest bestseller on her. So in the grand Elizabeth Moss tradition of playing literary-centered characters who may or may not be okay, continues.
She's found her niche.
I guess so. I'm trying to think. She's like a highbrow scream queen, sort of, in these situations. And, you know, like in the old days, you had the horror, like the Jamie Lee Curtis. This is the thinking person's scream queen, where you have a woman at the center of the story who has a lot going on, and we're very nervous about what's going to happen to and around her.
Yeah, it's like a primal scream of your soul.
Yeah.
What's the thing that's going around from the theme parks in... Is it theme parks in China that are like, please don't scream out loud because that spreads germs. Please scream in your heart.
Scream in your heart. That's a good one. I'm sure it'll be interesting. I'm sure she'll be great in it. And I'm sure I probably won't watch this because it makes me very uncomfortable, these kinds of movies.
Yeah, I love her so much. And the older I get, the less willing I am to like spend my free time being scared and in existential terror.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, may your efforts succeed, Elizabeth Moss, but I'll just be over here rewatching Mad Men.
Apparently, the name of Elizabeth Moss's production company is Love and Squalor, which is just a wonderful name for anything, but I'll take that as well. I guess what I would like to see, Elizabeth Moss could do whatever we want. She knows what she's doing. I guess, do I want her, could I get one of her, I don't know what I want from this. I'm Elizabeth Moss losing her grip on reality. I feel like we've seen that. Maybe I'm trying to think. I don't even know. Now I've pigeonholed her in my head as Elizabeth Ross rolls. I can't even think my way out of it.
I want to see her do something that's like the equivalent of the Scarlett Johansson role in Marriage Story.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe go the other way and just be like the straight up villain, like do the Kathy Bates role in Misery, you know, inflict that on some other people. Be subject, not object. All right. Well, Elizabeth Moss, look forward to that. I wonder how the psychological thriller. Clearly, I'd love to know. I'd know less about how these pre-publication books get in the hands of people like Elizabeth Moss and movie deals are made. I know there are book scouts and things, but I'd love a farm to table kind of story of how these happen. So if anyone knows of one out there, podcast@bookriot.com. As always, you can find show notes of this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast at bookriot.com/listen. I'm out next. Do you know who's joining you next week?
Vanessa's going to be here.
Oh, Vanessa. That's really bad for me because she's much more fun than I am. That's tough for me. But I will catch you on the flip side, which will be really at the end of August. We'll be really turning the calendar. And again, we're going to be starting those bonus episodes talking about summer reading. We're going to do a book nerd movie club in September. We'll have some more announcements about that and some other fun stuff happening. Rebecca, I'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.